Whatever it is, it's not right on the teleprompter. I don't know what that is. I've never seen that. I can't read it. There's no words on it. I can't do it. We'll do it live. No. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live.
Excuse me.
Sometimes I just took a bath to get warm.
Yeah. No, it's cold.
All right. Oh, okay.
So we have this heater in the basement, right? And the guests that we've been having have wanted to have it warmer down here. And I just like ream them for using energy when they shouldn't. And I like straight call them out. Like, what kind of world are you leaving to the children?
Just wow.
Put a sweater on.
Okay. All right. Let's get this show on the road, shall we? I don't want to exercise too much conversation. I feel like we'll have a lot of good stuff to talk about, but welcome to our podcast. To start things off, we thought it would be beneficial for everyone to know who the hosts for this show are going to be. Michael Penn is a tenured professor at Randolph College, where he teaches essentially really hard math. He also is on the cusp of 200,000 subscribers on YouTube teaching, you guessed it, really hard math. He'll tell you more about it in this episode. On the other side, we have Grace Pavloff, a first-gen college student studying in Northern Ireland. Traversing pre-adult life, Grace offers a young mind's perspective as she discovers what the world is like overseas. And lastly, Alexei Pavlov is a small town sports journalist who writes about local aspiring dream chasers seeking to make an impact on their world. He also serves as this podcast moderator. Together, we are the Penn and the Pavlovs. Welcome to the show. So, with that being said, this has been kind of a last second development. That's how I would describe it, at least. I was approached to by my gracious uncle, Michael Penn, who is, again, like I've mentioned before, a very smart man in his own right. But Michael, can you kind of describe to us why you wanted to do this kind of thing? And how'd you get involved in content creation, that kind of thing?
Oh, so maybe we'll answer this first question first of how I got involved in content creation. So I wanted to make some videos for my classes that I teach at wonderful Randolph College in Central Virginia. And so I did. I made some videos and I put them on the YouTube. And I got, you know, like maybe 10 or 15 views per video. And then I made some sort of popular math style videos. And also like hunted down some, you know, big math YouTubers on Twitter to try to get them to like give me a little bit of, you know, free juice, if it were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything took off. I don't know what to say. And now I have a huge or medium sized math YouTube channel.
So what?
Go.
What is the specific, is there a specific kind of like math that like, cause when I brag about you to other people, it's like, I have to tell them, I don't know what he's talking about, but I find it interesting and other people find it interesting. So like what's the kind of discipline that you work in?
Good question. So I think what got the channel to be popular were these math contest problems. Mm. So I would pick math contest problems from a variety of different countries around the world. Mm-hmm. And solve them and maybe give insights into how they were written and the tricks that are important for solving this type of problem and what like generalizations of that type of problem might look like. Really, my thinking was people live all over the world and they might like to see problems from their country. And it turns out that like I have a very international audience, I think, from doing this. Since, you know, the growth built off of these contest type problems, I still do those from time to time, but I try to do more topics that you would maybe not learn in college, but are related to what you would learn in college as a math major. I do that for a couple reasons. One, the math contest problems were getting stale for me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to keep it fun for me. And a lot of other channels popped up in my wake, not to like sound weird about it, doing the same kind of math contest problems. And so I wanted to like set myself apart. Mm. You know, essentially a lot of people can make math contest problem videos, but you know, I'm trying to make videos on topics that maybe not everyone can make videos on now.
And this is just in addition to all of that. This is kind of more separate from the math side of things. We want to get into other topics right in the future.
Oh yeah, yeah. So the podcast, why are we doing the podcast? Right. I don't know. How honest should I be?
I think we can be.
Walk.
Oh, okay.
I was on a walk and I was like really homesick for my hometown of Little Rock, Arkansas. Hmm. And I thought to myself, how could I reconnect with someone from my hometown of Little Rock, Arkansas? And I said, I'll just like cold email or cold text someone that I haven't talked to for like 15 years and ask them to start a podcast. But it didn't work. They didn't bite. Like, they were not interested. And so I tried that with another person and they weren't super interested. And then I tried that with your mom. And she was like not super interested, but she said that you would be interested.
Oh,
Alec.
Yeah.
But then I didn't want it to just be, I apologize. I didn't want it to just be two dudes because there's like so many podcasts, two guys talking.
Yeah.
So I wanted a woman's voice on here.
Mm.
So Grace is there.
And what a great segment, Michael. We're just gonna segue right into Grace. Grace, talk to us. You're my sister, but you know, I you're going to school overseas. What's life been like for you in the past year?
You know, it's been pretty good. It's definitely gotten better. It was very isolating moving to a new country, not having anybody around for thousands of miles that could give me a hug. That was definitely a hard thing to live with for a while, but it's gotten better and better. And I'm finally experiencing like the college life. I'm not only just doing my classes, I'm also, you know, doing athletics and I have a job and some really cool friends that I've collected. And life's going pretty good. It's going pretty good.
So maybe like remind everyone, I don't think you mentioned where you go to university.
That is true.
And where you came from.
Okay, so I went to high school in New York. Majority of the time I went to high school in New York City. And the university that I'm studying at currently is Queen's University Belfast, located in Belfast, Northern Ireland. I'm a second year student. There's out of 3 years, I study philosophy and politics. So my first year was during COVID. So I got here in around October because I was, you know, delayed getting over here, and all of my classes were online last year. So that's a little context.
Well, and also during that time in New York, I should say you mentioned that you're doing athletics overseas. You were a hell of an athlete in high school. By the time you moved to that charter school in New York City,
it wasn't a charter school.
Okay.
Public school.
They're different. Well, yeah, but it wasn't really a public school because it didn't abide by the public school curriculum. So that's kind of charter like.
No, but it was a public school.
Okay. Did you follow the
charter schools are public schools.
Yeah, no, our school
most was charter schools are publicly funded.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but we were not a charter school.
But
we're not being very precise here.
We're not being very, but did you follow the New York State curriculum? I have to get this point out.
To an extent, but we had to deal with the state, with the city, that we didn't have to do standardized testing, but that doesn't make us a charter school.
Okay, so you either follow it or you don't, and you guys don't, so.
But we're still a New York City school, not a charter school. I don't know what to tell you, Alec.
Whatever. Right, either way, the point that I was getting at is that the school didn't have athletics. Okay, the school didn't have athletics.
See, charter school doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's really related to.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay, continue. Continue.
This is going to be a great thing to edit. No. No, but like, I'm trying to beef you up. You know what I mean? So the, you were doing club lacrosse at the time, and you had interests of playing in college at one point, but those interests kind of evaporated and you chose to pursue other things. What is it that you are studying right now in school? What is, because it's, chances are that it's way different if you're studying something similar in the States versus where you are right now. You know what I mean? So like, what are you studying right now in school?
So I'm a joint honors major, I guess. So philosophy and politics. So take three courses or three modules of each course, for a year. At the moment, it's a lot of, modern philosophy, ancient Greek philosophy, very Westernized. It's very centrally Westernized, like thought. At the moment, I'm trying to get a head start on some of my final assignments, which are essays. And one of them is, you know, based around Wollstonecraft and the argument she has for them, like that men and women are morally equal. And then for another class, it's about explaining what we learn about freedom from slavery. Mm. Now, those topics we only really focus on for like a week. Mm-hmm. So we change topics every week. But there's a lot of, you know, like John Stuart Mill, Edmund Burke, mm-hmm. Berkeley, Locke, Hume, Kant,
right?
A lot of those guys, a lot of white guys, and their profound ideas that have changed the course of civilization. So that's a lot about what I'm learning right now.
What would be the most interesting topic you've discussed? Because as a journalist, we kind of go through that ethical question almost every day about certain topics, because every story is different. You know what I mean? So like, what's the most interesting philosophical question that you've come across?
I think the conversation surrounding the nature of animals versus humans and distinctifying traits between the two. And, you know, or at least from what I got, from what I was taught, was that, you know, there's a lot of agreement on the fact that what is innate to humans and not innate to animals is our ability to reason and our intelligence and our ability to like make and create things that are much more than just a dam or a stick. I don't know. I mean, you can't make a stick, but anyway. So I find those conversations really interesting, because personally, I think that animals are more intelligent than us in different ways. And it's like, how can we be all this and all that when we can't even see half the colors that exist, you know, or we can't hear certain wavelengths that half of the species in the world can, you know? So I don't know. I find that the most interesting to talk about, because initially a lot of people think that humans are just on the top of the food chain.
But we are.
But I don't.
But you're saying by some measurements, we're not.
By some measurements, we're not. By some measurements we are, because we choose to care about those measurements. But in terms of like abilities and skills, I don't know. I think there's some things that we overlook.
Like our ability to ruin the earth.
Yeah.
On top. Yeah.
Yeah. But then is that also like a flex?
Right. No.
No, like worst. It's like, wow. Yeah.
Well I mean, like, I mean,
totally the best at doing it. That's not like the best thing anybody could do.
No, that's my point.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it is quite interesting, you know, as we're gradually destroying this beautiful planet of ours. I do agree with your sentiment, Grace. I do. I think what you talk about in school is very interesting, and I wish I could go back and do it all again. But on that topic of who's smartest, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're the only species that has space traveled. So like, where does that like put us on like the topic of, well, like, who's on top of the food chain? I mean,
you can say there's that some microbes space traveled first when they fly on asteroids through space. So
there we go. Exactly.
Then are we, it depends on what your domain that you're talking about is, right? What is the extent of things that you're trying to compete against each other to see, oh yeah, we've done this and we haven't. Like, you could make that argument and exclude microbes from it, and then you would win. Mm-hmm. But then you could also make that argument and not exclude microbes, and then your thought isn't as profound as you wanted it to actually be.
Interesting. There we go. I like playing devil's advocate. That's why I like what you talk about.
Because I feel like that's also like a math thing, right, Michael? Like the domains, the extent of what you're going to accept certain variables to be. Or maybe that's more like science. I don't know. I could also just.
I mean, there are definitely like foundations at the base of mathematics, right? So we call them axioms. So there are axioms. They're like facts that are decided upon to be true.
Yeah.
That cannot be proven. Like, I don't know, in set theory, for instance, there's the axiom of the empty set. So we mathematicians accept that there is a set that does not have any elements. And there's the axiom of infinity, which is like, we as mathematicians accept that there should be a set containing infinitely many elements. You know, and then there's like Euclid's axioms of geometry, right? Like the fifth postulate is like maybe the most famous, which says that if you have a line and a point in the plane, there's a unique line parallel that goes through that point. So yeah. I mean, I think maybe to get to your point, yeah, there are things that are like not provable that are accepted to be true just to like start a logical argument in the first place.
Yeah. And I would like to make a connection to my course and that point about axioms. My last essay I had to do was on Locke and innate ideas. And if he successfully defended that innateness, that ideas and knowledge are not innate to beings. And he spoke in some detail about axioms. And that's when I first learned about those. And so I just think it's crazy how like maths connect to philosophy.
Oh yeah, so the foundations of math, the like veil between the foundations of math and philosophy is very thin.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not, I mean, a lot of the kind of original people who did work in the foundations of math, as you would say, were also like philosophers like Bertrand Russell, etc.
Were any of those people athletes?
You know, I don't know that. I don't think stuff like that was
popular. I don't think that matters.
No,
I'm not saying that. That's, you know, whether or not that matters can be decided upon later.
Right.
But no, I don't. I just don't think that stuff was recorded.
Right. Well, and like the only reason why I asked that is because like Aristotle, Pluto,
Plato.
I'm sorry, Pluto. I said Pluto. That'll be put that on the board for the first embarrassing moment on the podcast for Alexi. Just check that right there. Plato. They were. At least there were ideas that, you know, that they were like wrestlers, at least like they, I think Plato got his nickname from actually being a wrestler. So like, that's where, I don't know, that's where he got his name from. But I find it interesting that with science, math, philosophy, athletics, it's all kind of like together, you know what I mean? With I always appreciated the wrestler's mindset because it was always so authentic to me. It was so real. And a lot of the stuff that you read about with Pluto and stuff,
Plato,
Jesus Christ, I'm an idiot. I apologize. It's Sunday. I got done taking photos at OSU yesterday. I'm a little bit tired from that. But yeah, so like, sure. anyway, the point that I was getting at is that all of our topics, all of our backgrounds are very much connected in this weird universe that we find ourselves in. I mean, math and statistics, that is king of sports. Philosophy, how does a mind go through the rigors of a professional season, and all the factors that come away with that. I find both of those points to be very fascinating. So I'm sure that in this podcast we'll have a lot more to talk about later on, and I will make less mistakes. But at the same time, I think
or more.
I mean, who knows? I welcome it. But I do like this Maj Paj that we have here, because with all of our backgrounds, I think we can talk about a lot of different topics. I mean,
yeah, I think it'll make Alex feel good that, like, you know, he can try to connect athletics to math and philosophy to make him feel better.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll see.
Except for the fact that he calls it Pluto.
Well, how about this? I'll give you one example. Moneyball. Have anyone watched the movie Moneyball? Okay, no one's watched the movie Moneyball. All right, so back in the day, around the 1990s, okay, baseball was a very archaic medieval game, right? People weren't really looking at the details. And what I mean by that is you were looking at the product that was, say, a Barry Bonds, right? Oh, he's a strong player, he's fast, he can hit the ball. But are you looking at how consistent he is? Now, with Barry Bonds, that's a consistent guy. The Oakland A's, they had a manager, first name Billy. Oh my goodness, I forgot his name. But anyway, in the movie, he's played by Brad Pitt. The character that Brad Pitt plays, this organization is awful. Like, it's just, they don't have enough money for big name players to improve their team. They don't have the talent that they need. So what does Billy do? He hires someone out of the Cleveland Indians front office who likes statistics, a graduate of Stanford, didn't really major in any sports administration, just economics. And they use statistics. How often does a guy get on base? That's more valuable than anything else.
So that wasn't done until the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I thought statistics had been with baseball for much longer.
No. Well, I mean, like, statistics were, but people didn't use statistics to win games.
The teams didn't like employ statisticians they do now.
Exactly. Yeah. Where, like, statisticians, you don't necessarily need to have a background in baseball or whatever sport. You can just predict probability and win games, sell tickets. Those are what, like, statisticians are hired for. And so, you know, bringing math into sports, Grace, that is an example where math exceedingly accelerated how we judge the sport of baseball. And I'm not a big baseball fan.
Statistics did. I don't know that that's math.
Well, I mean, math in general, the blanket term. No. But statistics.
They're kind of too separate.
Stretching it, Alex.
Well, anyway.
So I think you should tell your story, what I'm saying. Alexi.
What's up?
I think you should tell your story.
Oh, well, then there you go. Where do we start? So, yep.
Keep it short.
I am short. I'm very short. I'm 6'4". Weigh a fraction than what I used to weigh when I played in college. But anyway, I'm a journalist. Like I said before, I write about local sports. I take photos. That's a passion of mine. I am now in the midst of the high school winter season. So basketball's kicking up, wrestling, my favorite sport, is kicking up. Like I mentioned before, also, I take photos for one of the highest profile college teams in the country. It has been an experience. This is my first time really taking photos for professional and what I consider quasi-professional teams. You know, some people don't see it college athletics as professional. I consider Ohio State to be a professional team. 110%.
Well, I think that thinking is changing, right? Wasn't there just a recent law in California?
Yeah. So yeah, that's
about a payment for NCAA athletes.
So the state of California, they made a ruling. It was about 5 years ago, I think, at this point, maybe even four, honestly, maybe three. But anyway, they made a ruling that basically said that college athletes can make money off of their likeness. That was only for the state of California, though. So athletes outside of the state of California couldn't do it. If you were an athlete under the NCAA rules, you had to abide by the NCAA rules. So there's a perfect example. Before players could, you know, make money off of their name, image, and likeness, that's called NIL, there was a punter for the University of Central Florida. The NCAA saw that he was posting videos of him punting, literally just him punting, and he happened to be a player on UCF. They said, you either delete the channel or you're no longer a Division I football player. And so he chose to not be a Division I football player because he was actually making money on YouTube. Mm-hmm. So, and that's just, and now he's since grown. He does other stuff now. It was probably the best decision he could have made for him at the time. Fast forward to this year, actually probably a little over a year ago, the NCAA ruled by popular demand that athletes in Division I athletics can make money off of their NILs, name, image, likeness. That opened the door for sponsorships. There's some safeguards, some rules that they have to follow. Like, I don't think that they can be sponsored or paid for by like a beer company or like a liquor company, pharmaceuticals, supplements. Actually, probably not the supplement part, but I mean, from what I've seen from guys like CJ Stroud, Garrett Wilson, these are just a couple of Ohio State Buckeyes. They like have paid partnerships for like seltzer waters, just like really basic stuff. Local businesses sponsor them for all sorts of things. And I mean, like, you know, I think it's been a good thing. There was a story out of BYU of one of the players who got a lot of money for NIL for one deal, I believe he made, and he gave like four walk-ons full ride scholarships.
Oh wow.
So
the athlete did.
Yeah. So yeah, and people were like, I think people were worried that the idea of paying college athletes any amount of money would tarnish the integrity of the sports, when in actuality, not paying them tarnishes the integrity of the sport, because especially at the Division I level, I mean, I play Division III college football. I don't think I deserve to get paid at all. I played because I loved the game, I needed to play, and I got what I needed out of it. But when you go to a Division I school, football, if you're just playing football, football is your life. Like, that is it. It, like, your classes matter, but they really don't matter as much as what you do on Saturday. Because your goal at that point, I think everyone can probably be honest, like, if there's an opportunity to go to the NFL, they'd take it. Less than 1% actually goes into the NFL, but that's the main goal. And I think for a sport that you put your body on the line for so much, I think guys want to get paid for that. I think I would too. You know, bashing my head into a concrete wall every day, essentially, not really, not literally, but, you know, putting my body on the line definitely leads me to believe that it wouldn't be a bad idea for players to make money off of what they do on the field, or on the court for that matter, or on the mat, or wherever they are. It was a very extended conversation on my part. Well, Grace, do you have any questions? Do you have anything to add?
Oh, so, you know, I was, I want to like talk a little bit about what you just talked about for a second.
Right.
You know, I was like part of a Division I diving team, Indiana University, and not everyone on our team should have been paid.
Right.
But the two Olympians maybe should have been allowed to get sponsorships.
Well, and
because what would they, I mean, they were like the face of women's diving in the U.S., like at that time, like 2004 or whatever.
2004.
And, you know, they didn't get anything out of it, essentially.
Well, and like, and like, that's the thing, right? Like, how many hours do you believe that they worked on a weekly basis on their, on like their craft?
Well, I mean, we trained a lot.
Like, yeah, a lot, I would assume. But you know, like, what do you mean by a lot?
We had 2 days, 5 days a week. An additional 2 days a week we had, or 2 or 3 days a week we had strength training. So that's what, like 7 or 8 sessions already a week. And then, you know, training or competitions on the weekend. Saturdays, usually. We had Sundays off.
How long were your training sessions for?
Each one was an hour and a half of pool time and like maybe half an hour of warm up dry land.
So like basically 2 hours, 2.5 hours, give or take.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, like, you know, with like stuff like that, like you're demanding so much out of someone at that point. That's a full-time job.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like a full-time job. And like the fact that you're, again, like with football, it hits home for me because we know now that football is such a damaging sport for the mind. Guys, when they leave the sport, what I hate to see a lot of the time is the kinds of contributors to society they become after. Because a lot of the time, I don't really have a figure for this, but a lot of the time you'll see guys who get down on their luck. We just had this, we had a story that happened recently, not we, but like in the sports world, there was a story of Zach Stacy, former running back for the Rams and the Jets. He just literally assaulted his girlfriend on camera, the mother of his child. And it was one of the hardest things to watch because I know that there are a lot of guys who are prone to violence like that in this sport. And I wish that there was a way for them to, because who knows, I don't really know what factors in his life like led him to that or why he chose to do that. It's awful. And I guess like I feel like if guys just had some financial stability right after the sport, after they've done what they've can, I think they'd be better people too. Like I, for me, when I stopped playing the sport, I was thankful, but I had a lot of spite because I felt like I sacrificed a lot more and didn't really get a whole lot out of it. It was, you know, I felt like my body was used, and a lot of times it was, you know, I was used on scout team every other day. You know, I my knees are not what they used to be, so I couldn't imagine what it would be like for an individual at like the Division I level. You know, it's Grace, what would you say is the philosophical or ethical dilemma of paying college athletes?
I think there's an ethical dilemma of football existing.
Yes. Yes. 110%. I would agree with that.
I do think there's like, I mean, I remember when this conversation was happening when I was like in high school and stuff, like freshman year. And part of me always thought like school playing athletics in school is different from playing athletics professionally. Right. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was like, you're going to pay a student for playing a sport. I feel like that could just be, you could just extort the student, you know, but then obviously like with what you said, it's more of just like them getting compensation for their craft, right? But at the beginning, like initially, and when I was young, I mean, I'm talking about when I was like 14, like thinking about it, I was like, for me, the logic was just, they're students. Why should they get paid? They're there for university. Like, they choose to do those things. Like, it is really unfortunate that like the university is extorting them for their talent and stuff. But that's what you get for playing. You have to wait until you make it to the big leagues to finally like be deserving of something. But I don't think that way anymore. So I think that's very wonderful.
But that brings up a good point on the topic of diving. Where's the professional league for divers? Do we know? Does anyone know off the top of their head the professional league for divers?
I mean, it's not exactly like that, right? Because it's a predominantly Olympic sport, right? Right. So only the best of the best get to continue to participate after college.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, not the best of the best, like the percent that go to the NFL, but like less than that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Only a dozen people, right?
Maybe like a dozen like from each school or country. I'm sorry.
Like a dozen from each country, right? So you're funded by national federation, or maybe also you have brand sponsorships or something.
Right. Well, it's you know, with football, because I'm thankful that football is not an Olympic sport, because if it was, the United States would win every single time and it wouldn't be interesting at all. But the thing with football is that it is, I like to think that football teaches you a lot about what life is like as a team game, because life is like literally a team game. Depending on how you play it, it can be a solo game, but football taught me a lot about leadership, the goods and bads about it, authority, the goods and bads about it. And like a lot of those like lessons like translated well into my life. So I guess I do appreciate the fact that I was a student of the game. And again, I'm a student of the game. I shouldn't get paid like at all. But I think for someone like Chris Olave, or better yet, CJ Stroud, he threw for 400 yards, right? And 6 touchdowns in the first half of yesterday's game. That is hard to do at any level. That is really hard to do. And especially in the Big Ten, going up against the top 10 opponent. If we're talking like numbers here, I mean, Michigan State had the country's leading rusher going in. Ohio State was known to not be as consistent on the defensive end of the ball. Like all of the strategy and the production that goes into Ohio State football, those guys need to get paid. Cause like once you're on the field and you see like what pregame's like, what the opening's like for the team, what the game is actually like, you're just kind of like, oh, the university makes millions of dollars off these kids and they don't see a dime of it. That's kind of weird. So,
yeah. So I have a feeling that Grace and I don't have like as formed of opinions of this stuff, because maybe we haven't lived the world.
Right. Well, I mean,
same way. I mean, speak up, Grace, but.
Well, Grace, you're doing athletics in college, so, but it's not like, you know, a varsity.
I'm my training is 2 hours a week. Like, okay, guys, like I have to pay £5 every time I want to enter the athletic center. Okay.
You don't get in there for free?
No, you can get a monthly membership, but it's like £16 a month, and I'm just, you know, it is a deal. Anyway, no, like I'm doing, but I am actually, news for the family, I'm actually the secretary and the treasurer of the lacrosse club at Queen's University Belfast.
Hey, you heard it here first, folks. That's news.
Yeah, that's news. A 30-year girl is the president, Because it just made more sense. Like, because we both did the training and it's just the two of us. And she was like, do you mind if I'm? And I'm like, honestly, no. Like, you've been here longer than I have. Like,
how many seniority. How many Americans were on the team? And where are they from?
There's three of us total.
And where are they from?
Oh, that's a lot. That's more than
that's a lot. Yeah, there is. One of them is from California. I don't know where. And then the other one is from Ohio. Now, like, we've already talked about this girl from Ohio, but I don't remember where in Ohio she's from.
Chagrin. She's from Chagrin.
Okay. Well, there you go. That's yeah.
So how many Americans are
I don't know.
Queen's University? Like,
oh, I don't know.
Is the percentage is the percentage on the lacrosse team? Is that what it is? Higher than the percentage of the whole school? Like, how often do you run into another American?
As she checks her phone.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to see if I can get like some statistics for you. Oh, we've been welcoming U.S. students to Belfast for decades with around 200 U.S. students enrolling every year on a variety of, so like 200.
And well, I think that's enrollment. But like, I wonder what like the on campus, because like there were tons of students enrolled at Earlham, but only less than 1,000 were actually on campus. So like, how many? Yeah,
like I don't think there's like. Well, hold on. What's it called? What's the number? Population? QUB population? That's not the word.
Demographics. Okay,
so there's 20 demographics. So there's like 25,000 students at the university.
Okay,
that's
fairly large.
That's bigger than my college, yeah, by far.
Yeah, so I would say like there's a handful. I'm friends with, I have like 2, 3, 4. There's, I probably know like 5 other Americans.
So it's not in like, my year. So it's not common at all, but you're not like a complete anomaly.
No. And there is a lot of, like, I have friends who speak with, like, not an American accent, but speak the English that I speak, but they've never even been to America. And so a lot of times, like, we'll go out and, like, they'll be checking our IDs and stuff. And, you know, it says, like, from France or from Spain or from, like, these places. And they're like, excuse me. And they're like, no, like, they went to, like, international schools.
They learned English from like an American or something.
Yeah, so they sound like they're American. So I feel like I'm friends with a lot more Americans than I am just because they speak like me.
That kind of sounded like, and I'm glad I didn't ask this question, because I thought that from what you were telling me, it sounded like you were friends with people who were American, like. For example, if you're in the armed services, right, you have the opportunity to be deployed overseas to a base, say in France, right? Oftentimes children are born on those bases. And at that point, I don't know, and maybe this has nothing to do with your circumstance, Grace, with the Americans at your school, but I find it very interesting that, you know, like someone like Kobe Bryant, right, who lived in Italy for years, got ingrained in that culture, learned how to speak Italian, learned how to speak like 5 different languages, I think. And he's, you know, and his father was in the armed services. So I don't know if that's anything, if that really relates to the conversation that we're having. But I think it's interesting that we live in a world where you can be American, but not technically born on U.S. soil, you know, or you can learn English and not be American at all. You know what I mean? I wish Americans.
Well, yeah, but you can also, yeah, that's a little less, because you can learn English and be Canadian.
Very true.
Or
because British. Canadians are a different breed.
Or British.
Or Irish.
Or Welsh.
South African.
Hey.
Australian.
Oh yeah, Australian, yeah.
New Zealand.
So Grace, describe to me like the academic calendar. So how many courses do you take at a time?
So it definitely varies depending on what course. So I'm only going to speak for myself personally. I'm in the HAP department, so history, anthropology, politics, and philosophy. So what are, and I'm also joint honors, so it'd look a little bit different if I was single honors. So if I was just studying philosophy or just studying politics, but since I'm a joint honors, I have to take 3 modules, which are like classes of each subject per year. So okay. In one semester, I take 3 modules. And this semester, it is 2 politics, 1 philosophy. Next semester, it's going to be 2 philosophy, 1 politics.
So in the US, students are generally taking 4 or 5 courses per semester. Yeah. So I would assume that your courses are much beefier.
Yeah, so I only have 3 assignments per class per semester.
They're very intense.
Yeah, so it's like 10% will either be like tutorial participation, which is like a weekly discussion you'll have for like an hour based on the topic of the week. So that will be like 10%. Or if the class doesn't grade you on tutorial, because like one of my classes, we have a tutorial, but you're not graded on it, you get graded on a learning log, which will be like 500 or so words about like a reflection of what you've learned and stuff like that. So that will be like 10%. But then, yeah, so the first assessment, which would happen during like midterms, but for us, it's like right after reading week. I'll explain that in a second. So the first assessment will be like 30-35% of our total marks. And then the second one will be like 60-65.
Okay. So you have a midterm and a final.
A midterm and a final, and that's it. Like that is.
That's a nightmare. That sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. So that's why I'm getting
ahead. I mean, they don't sugarcoat it like we do in the US, right?
No, it's
weekly homework that pads your grade and like extra credit.
It's easier for me to get an extension because I'm registered with disability services. So like that's as much sugarcoating as I'll get is like maybe like a nice free extension, not penalized. But yeah, so we have 11 weeks, but also kind of 12, 11 weeks of classes, or of 11 weeks is like the timeline, right? And in week 6 is reading week, which is a week off. And so that's basically the week before midterms are due. So it's basically like reading week is like when you're reading, studying, getting prepared for that assessment. And then week 12 is sort of like it's not really reading week, but it'll be like sort of like that last week before the final assessments due. And you'll have like the final conversations with your professors and lecturers about assignments, getting last help, clarifying certain concepts and stuff before the final assessment is due.
These assessment like sit down exams or are they papers?
So for me, they're essays.
Okay.
My degree, it's essays. So they'll
that's
give
actually
us,
really good.
Yeah. So you'll get a module guide at the beginning of the term and it'll explain, like they'll break down all of the grading stuff and they'll give you the essay questions on the first day, or if not, like the week before classes start. So I've already picked my essay questions for final ones to get like a head start, because they'll creep up on you and they're going to be like, oh yeah, I didn't mention that. So like the first essays would be like 2,000 to 250 words. Or 2,500 words. And then the second essay will be like 3,000 to 350.
You know,
so I don't know if it's just because I study math and we never had anything measured in number of words, but I have no intuition for how long that is.
So like 1,500 words, what is that? I think that's like a page and no, that's 2 pages and 2 pages and a quarter, I think. Because like 750, so I guess like where I'm coming from is this. Grace, she has, rather you, because I'm talking to you, you have like a word minimum, right? You at minimum, you have to write 2,000 words, make pretend, right? For me, I had a cap. So like as a journalist, I could only write a story and not go above 750 words, because the point of the style in which I write is get rid of the bullshit, get to the point.
It's also the same thing for us. That's why that difference of minimum and maximum is 500 words. You have to make it between 2,000 or 2,500 words.
Okay.
You have 500 words to fit your essay between.
Right.
And you do have, like, I think this is something they introduced during COVID, but you get 10% word count leeway on either end. So if you go 10% above the word count or 10% below the word count, you're not going to get penalized for it. So that's like 250 words or something, like, or 200, depending on what it is. So
yeah,
it's roughly, Michael, like, anywhere from like 4 to like 6 pages.
Oh, okay.
2,000?
Yeah,
I guess.
3,000.
Oh, 3,000.
We're talking like minimum 2,000.
Yeah.
Maximum 3,000.
Oh, yeah.
4 to 6 pages.
Yeah. 3,000 is about, 6 pages
long. Yeah. And the goal of it also is to be like, even though that doesn't seem like, I'm used to writing, like, in high school, I actually had to write it was supposed to be like a 5-page essay on math, but I ended up writing like 13 pages. I wrote 13 pages on math.
Jesus.
Like, yeah.
Like, what'd you write about?
This was something about
how like, I just don't know what.
Explain every single thing you do and why you do it. Why do you measure angles this way? What is it opposite adjacent? Why are those congruent? You know, why do those angles equal 100 degrees? What assumptions are you making? Like, I would literally explain every single step and why I did it and what the rationale was behind it and why it's true.
Being congruent is an adjective defined in Webster Dictionary. That's how detailed you would go.
No, not.
Well, just congruent is.
Yeah, not what congruent means, but like why things are congruent. What's the math term?
Yeah. And that's what I was graded on. They wanted us to understand what we were doing, so that's why I wrote so much on that.
Do you know any people studying maths?
I do.
Yeah, you should. We should have them as a guest.
Yeah.
I don't know, because the relationship I have with this person.
Do they know me?
I actually did tell him about you.
Yeah.
It's like, my uncle does math on YouTube.
And he's pretty good at it.
He's pretty good at it. the circumstances.
Okay. Well, I don't want you to have I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable situation, but if there's someone else.
Well, that brings up a good talking/wrapping up point. So in the future, right, we're gonna include multiple varying different kinds of topics, from dating apps all the way to whatever we can possibly think of, Bitcoin to the moon, maybe some socialist theories we might discuss, that kind of thing, or whatever comes to mind. But with that, we want to include some guests of our own, and we'll try to bring you some interesting conversations. As always, if you like what you're hearing, leave a comment, leave a like, let us know what you think, let us know what you want to hear. We want to hear from the community on topics and such. And if you have anyone that, you know, would be interested in being on this podcast, that has an interesting background, that has neat stories to tell, recommend them over. We have an audience, and we have the people to ask questions. So with that being said, my name is Alexi. This has been The Pen and the Pavlovs with Grace Pavlov and Michael Penn, and we will talk to you next time.
Whatever it is, it's not right on a teleprompter. I don't know what that is. I've never seen that. I can't read it. There's no words on it. I can't do it. We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live.